let's start the show.
It's February 28th, 2013. Welcome to This Is Only a Test, the official podcast of Tested.com. I'm Will Smith. I kind of jumped the gun on the music a little bit this week. I had to blast that early out real fast.
Dot was not also an elongated dot.
So I usually put the tested dot. I usually start the music when I say tested.
Well, walk us through in your head your.
So there's a real specific process. Norman Chan always is here.
Okay.
Gary's still on deadline, so we hope he'll be back next week. But no ETA at this point. Nothing is guaranteed. Yeah, so it used to be that you would say, hey, let's start the show, and then I would add the little foot feedback thing in post.
I don't say it anymore for people who are not watching the video.
We've taken that away from you.
All right.
Sorry, Norm.
Well, it used to be whoever. It was a rotation.
Sometimes it was a guest, but
hey,
now I just,
show.
You know, I can do it. I can do it anytime I want, like constantly. I can just do that all the time.
That's awesome.
And that's so that it has the little filter, which I think, you know, adds to the. I don't think anybody cares about this but me, probably. Safe assumption there.
Well, it's a little flourish.
Yeah, it's just a thing. It's the one flourish that we have in an otherwise 2 hour and change show
and
about
it's
nothing,
anachronistic,
essentially.
Or not anachronistic. It's skeuomorphic.
It's not skeuomorphic. It's anachronistic.
It's anachronistic.
Yeah, it's like it's not supposed to sound like
it's
a telephone
out of place.
Filter. Yeah. So and then I play the music, but the music has a little bit of a lead, and you got to get that because if you don't do that right, then you listen to too much time, and there's not enough music. And
so there are many things going on, but essentially it boils down to the date.
Yeah, that you got to get that right. That's phase
very
one.
Important.
The year also has to be right.
The year, it's 2013.
This time of year, it's easy to mess that up.
Yep, and then tested. And at that point in your head, you're glad you got the date and you're glad you got the...
It's all downhill from there. The rest of the show's easy.
You're an autopilot.
Exactly.
And then you go tested.com.
And sometimes I stretch it out really long if I start the music too late. This is way too much sausage making here.
Personal preference.
Yeah, exactly. So what are you doing this week? You got something new on the table there.
We'll talk about that later, when we're testing.
Yeah. It's kind of a slow news week, despite being Mobile World Congress this week.
Two events going on this week.
What's the
Mobile World
event?
Congress and TED.
Oh,
TED
right.
In Long Beach.
What's your favorite TED talk so far, Norm?
Of this year, the TED talks are not online this year.
Well, people are tweeting about it, though.
I wish I was there so to watch them, but TED seems like
so you're still pro because there's a TED backlash.
No, very pro TED.
Okay,
pro
TED, I think TED is awesome.
But I'm pro TED in all its forms. Which seems to be exactly where the backlash is.
You mean you think there's too much TED? Like
no,
in the old days when it was just one.
I
mean, you think that people think there's too much TED?
Yes, I think absolutely that people think that TED is diluted. Because in the old days.
Meaning 2 years ago. Maybe three.
2009 is when TED really kicked off. 2008 even.
2008 was the first year I thought, man, I wish I had paid to go to TED this year.
Well, you can't get paid. You can't pay to go to TED. In 2008, TED was. And I think still currently it's invite only.
No, you can pay $4,000 and apply.
Oh, you have to apply. You pay and apply.
Well, you don't pay until you're accepted.
Right. So you have to apply, get invited, and then you pay.
If you, in 2008, 2009, if you paid $4,000, you could get in basically.
Basically, because Chris Anderson is the founder of TED, not Wired Chris Anderson.
Well, formerly of Wired.
Formerly Chris Wired Anderson. DIY drone Chris Anderson.
It's our old boss, Chris Anderson.
Chris Anderson, the founder of Future Publishing,
whose
great innovation to the world was sticking a floppy disk to a magazine cover.
I think his great innovation to the world now is TED, probably.
At that point.
Yeah.
At that point, what his success boiled down to, he thought it was brilliant and. It absolutely was.
It solved a problem. In the old days, you may not remember this, but in the old days, you would buy a computer magazine and you would have to type in programs from the back of the computer magazine. It took like 2 hours if you were a slow typist. So being
and
able to just dump
pages,
a floppy in,
which was expensive,
great.
But incredible value.
Well, and it let them charge £10 for the magazine because it was an English publishing company.
From that, bundling CDs and DVDs and so on, and the rest is history.
I spent like 4 years trying to get rid of the CD on Maximum PC, and I never could
get
make it
rid
happen.
Of the CD.
Yeah,
people like the CD.
Well, by the time 2010 rolled around, 2009 rolled around, you know, 600 megabytes of data on a disc, not that awesome for people who have broadband.
DVD
at that point would have been cool. We didn't have a TBD. We couldn't afford that. Mm. Anyway.
Anyway, so Chris Anderson founded TED, an organization. TED stands for Technology Entertainment Design.
Yeah.
It's great.
Entertainment or education?
Entertainment.
Okay.
That's why you can have J.J. Abrams talk about.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough.
Go on TED. And I don't remember the first TED Talk I saw was. I know what the first big TED Talk was. The first really viral, I guess it was still, YouTube was around at that point, but the first, and it was all closed, you know, proprietary players, yeah, you know, Flash BMW player. Ads and such. The first big TED Talk was the neurobiologist, the woman who had a stroke and recounted how her thought process as she was having the stroke because she knew
what happened.
She knew exactly what's going on in her brain and could convey exactly what was happening as it was happening, and then convey that experience in the TED Talk in 10 minutes was incredible.
I forget
her name. Oh gosh, she was just on the radio 2 weeks ago. But it was a wonderful talk, and I think that was the first TED Talk that really
Jill Bolt.
No, Jill something.
Bolte?
Jill, no, Jill.
Yeah, she had a massive stroke and watched as her brain functions, motion, speech, etc. Yes. Jill Bolt Taylor, sorry.
Jill Taylor.
Yeah.
Jill Taylor.
Oops.
And from there, people reading about TED, because you had to apply, and it was like $4,000 to $5,000, it really felt like this insider Illuminati club. Like, let's bring the smartest people, or the people who some people deem the smartest and most noteworthy people in the world.
I would say just together. The most interesting. It's a collection of interesting talks. It's not an overall theme.
I know, but the idea, yeah, though, the way it presented itself seemed like it was this very mysterious conference where you get really people with big ideas to come together and share them and try to change the world. And, you know, Al Gore did a talk and Bill Gates done talks.
Done talks?
Yep. And most of those talks never made it online, but it was all recorded, and it was a very interesting experiment.
Well, the idea is it's I mean, the thing that most people don't know is there's a ton of conferences that are either for really super wealthy investors or investment brokers and stuff like that. There weren't a ton that were just about learning new things, which is kind of the overarching theme of TED.
Sharing ideas. It was a big networking conference, yeah, also, but the brilliance of it was that they could then bring that, and maybe it was part of the original scope of the conference, maybe not, but also expose that video then to people outside.
Well, and then go even further and bring, like, and make TED a little more local.
Start up small, like, TEDxes, yeah, TEDeds, and, you know, TED all over.
And specific themed ones for medicine, science, whatever.
It's absolutely, yeah, franchised, and I know people who've spoke at TEDxes, and they have good ideas, but at this point, TED almost seems like an Apple keynote event or a big corporate keynote event where people vie to announce their products at TED.
Well, I don't know if it's that. I don't know if I'd say product based, but definitely somebody who has an interesting idea that will be a product three years from now.
Maybe not by design, and yeah, obviously not, clearly not all of the talks at TED, but no, at least the ones that were reported on in the technology press seem to be the interesting tech numbers. Because you had the MIT Sixth Sense stuff came out of, yeah, TED.
The Leap, I think, was a TED talk originally.
The what?
The Leap hand motion tracker thing was...
I didn't see that one. I know that the Jeff Hahn, the big wall, multi-touch wall, right, was a TED talk.
There was another one. There was a...
things that are now... We know a lot
of the drone stuff that are the drone startups, sure, have spoken there. I know.
Yeah, people save up, you know, do the research and then do the presentation. Well, at TED.
I mean, the thing they look for, but part of that is that they do a good job curating the speakers at TED, and making sure that they get people who are interesting. Like, they do a really good job.
And they had bad experiences in the past where people did a TED talk.
Well, there was one guy.
There was one guy.
Yeah.
That one guy.
And he was kind of a jerk about it, by all reports.
By all reports, that was a big PR thing for him. Mm-hmm. But there's definitely there are politics of TED.
For the most part, though, it seems like the people who are doing it seem to be doing stuff for the right reason. I mean, obviously, it's a huge stage if you get an opportunity to speak there.
And also a huge marketing opportunity for movies. Like, yeah, Prometheus.
Yeah. Oh God, that one.
Oh, but totally fine. I think it's totally fine. I think it,
I mean, the thing,
the goal is admirable, and if more people are educated about these things because of it, I'm okay with it.
Well, and the thing about TED is, and doing any kind of conference like that, is even though they charge a ton of money to the attendees, the cost of running that kind of high-profile conference in terms of like just the food service and stuff that they have to bring to the table
is
enormous.
Yes.
So, you know, they if they need to get sponsorships to keep being able to do it, I'm fine with them getting sponsorships to keep being able to do it. And if Prometheus is a sponsorship, great. Fantastic.
So this week at TED, the presentations aren't online yet, but the reports, because you know journalists go and write about events at TED.
Yeah, we really should have. That's worth $4,000 if we could get in. I don't think at this point we can get in.
Well, different discussion.
Yeah.
But the big things that I've read that have come out of it are there's a lot of 3D printing stuff going on. There's one talk about 4D printing. Mm-hmm. Printing an object and then the object unfolds after a while.
So no, it's not after a while. It's like smart materials, basically. So they put two materials that have different electrical properties together or energy properties, and one expands when attached to water and one doesn't. So when you take this model that you print with the two materials, drop it in water, the one side that expands makes it kind of fold into a pre-designed shape.
Yep.
So you
which was not appropriate for one printing.
Yeah.
But is the desired shape. After a while,
it's kind of like the self-assembling boxes that you just you put them flat, and when you get a magnet above them, they snap into the right place.
Yeah, yeah, which is cool,
but 3D printed. Yeah,
that's very cool. There's a talk on invisibility cloaks. So the guy who's working on material that will let you see through it.
But also
hide objects behind it, specific objects behind it within a certain distance. There's a demo for that.
Crystals, it turns out, is a secret.
Crystals
of that.
Refracting,
yeah,
all but refraction. And then there's a demo for just new gesture interfaces. People always love talking about. It's a thing that everyone can relate to. New human computer interface models, because although touch is very prevalent in today's technology world,
hold on, we want prevalent, to
prevalent,
prevalent,
prevalent in prevalent. Today's prevalent,
prevalent, executable.
Prevalent.
I had to channel my inner Ryan Davis for that. Sorry.
Prevalent.
Apologies.
In today's world, we're always looking for the next thing that might complement modern input.
So I found a list of the most popular TED Talks from 2012.
We should go through those.
Presented by TED.
Okay.
See what we've seen. Jill Bolt Taylor's Stroke of Insight is the name of that talk from 2008 is number two. So still very popular. What do you think number one is?
From 2012?
As overall. Viewed in 2012.
J.J. Abrams' Mystery Box.
No. J.J. Abrams doesn't even make the list. Stephen Hawking is on the list. Steve Jobs is on the list.
I forgot that Steve Jobs did a TED Talk.
His was about living when you know you're going to die.
Huh.
It was a good talk. You should watch that. It's worth watching. Mary Roach, you know, the 10 things you didn't know about orgasms is on the list. It's constant. You know, there's obvious applicability to the internet there.
Okay.
Ken Robinson. Schools Killing Creativity is the number one. And I think that's probably because every teacher I've ever known has posted that on Facebook. It's the one about, it's not the one about math class being taught, math being taught the wrong way by memorization and rote. It's about the idea that
I have no problem
school,
with either memorization or rote.
Well, but I mean,
I grew up in a generation of kids who did nothing but memorization, rote, and baby formula. And you know what? I think we turned out all right.
You could have been 8 IQ points smarter.
On average.
On average.
On average.
You were breastfed. Thanks, Mom. Me too. I was a formula kid too. The thing for me though is in the post-internet world, I feel like teaching the way they taught stuff when I was a kid is much less useful now. Like rather than make me memorize when a bunch of bullshit historical battles and stuff happened. I'd much rather learn the underlying causes as we understand them of those conflicts and then know how to Google
that.
But the thing they should teach you is how to use search engines. Because if you know how to use Google, you can find anything you need to know.
Right. But I think the point of schooling and I do not have a degree in education. So, but from what my understanding is
your cognitive science degree is something that a lot of teachers get though.
Yes, but I think that there are a lot of externalities to the traditional schooling, memorization, and things that you learn that's outside of the actual material itself that's important, such as work ethic
Agreed.
And memorization and having good memory. And And yes, Googling skills are important and very applicable to jobs, but there are a lot of things like the discipline that required to do the rote tests are.
Well, there's some stuff that should be memorized and there's some stuff that shouldn't. And I think that the challenge for me is that we, you know, when I went to college and we started learning whys instead of whats, things became a lot easier for me.
Oh, no, and learning the whys were extremely, extremely important.
Right. I mean, because if you look at something like learning calculus and physics, literally the calculus was invented to explain physics. And if you take calculus by itself or physics by itself, there's a lot that doesn't make sense. And when I was in college and took my calculus class that was attached to the physics class, so you had to take them both at the same time, and they moved at the same pace, suddenly both calculus and physics became much easier. Derivatives are much easier to understand in the context of acceleration.
My fear is that if you just teach kids the whys and prioritize that over the whats, you get a generation of hipster philosophers who know nothing and just question everything.
Well, okay. Irrational fears are a thing that is real. You can have all the irrational fears you want. I don't know. I think that that's what I think. Anyway, a couple of others. David Gallo did Underwater Astonishments. I don't think I've seen that one. The Sixth Sense video, mm-hmm. which we had on the site. The follow up. That's the Spider-Man suit. The Spidey Sense, right?
No, Sixth Sense is the necklace that you wear around that projects that senses. Things around you, and then projects a screen on your hand.
Any surface,
surface becomes a computing display, and it can scan things like books and people.
Right. Patty Mays demoing Sixth Sense and Pravda of Mystery, and Tony Robbins talking about why we do what we do, or the top
why
six.
Do we do what we do, Tony Robbins.
I didn't see that one either. I didn't watch the Tony Robbins one. I know that's hard to believe. Yeah, I mean, I would just say, like, there's always something interesting. If I subscribe to that TED podcast feed, and even if you're just listening to the audio versions, they're very interesting. That's the NPR thing. There's also just a feed of everything new that they're releasing, and I kind of graze through that every once in a while when I want to watch something cool. So that's happening this week. I think the most interesting thing I've seen so far was the 4D printer. I think that's the potential that has is a real application for 3D printers that is kind of been lacking so far. So.
Yeah, we should talk about 3D printers more.
We can talk about 3D printers.
We can talk about 3D printers now. Did you ever listen to that Chris Anderson talk?
I have not listened. No, I didn't. The Planet Money one?
Not the Planet Money one.
No.
Chris Anderson was in town.
The one that you posted the other
Monday.
Yeah.
Yes. And he did a talk at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. Mm-hmm. It's the talk he's been giving for the past 6 months to promote his book.
Yeah. The Maker's Book.
The Maker's Book. Yeah. And the Maker's Book was, he left Wired, I want to say,
six months ago, maybe.
Right as the book came out, and I think one of the last issues of Wired he did was that the design issue. Mm-hmm. I think it still is one of my favorite issues in recent memory, from variety of reasons. It's the one with Brie on the cover.
Yes.
It's very cool.
With the Replicator 2.
It was an announcement of the Replicator 2, and when we went to New York, it was right when...
As we were getting on the plane, I think, was when I saw the tweet from Brie.
The issue came out, and because they announced Replicator 2 like a week before we went to New York. And when we went to the MakerBot store there in Soho, they had the letters from the Wired cover, because mm-hmm. they made those letters. From a design perspective,
they printed them.
It was awesome. And yeah. The whole issue had a story on Nerf weapons, had a story on Etsy, had a story on Gorilla Glass. It was really cool. Anyway, Chris Anderson really, really believes in the maker movement.
It's an extension to the future is free and the...
So he's had those three big ideas.
Yeah.
In terms of the cover stories for Wired.
Yeah. The tail,
idea is that
the long tail.
The long tail, which absolutely, it maybe not necessarily the newest idea, but he wrote the book on it.
And he hooked it to Amazon, which was the first thing.
It's a popularized big idea.
My dad knows what the long tail is. No.
Exactly. He popularized it, and great for him. And it's totally a real thing. And a lot of lessons learned. And then his next big idea was freemiums, mm-hmm. and everything is going to be free. I don't think that really panned out. Although, if you take it, I mean, in terms of video games, and mm-hmm. people paying for stuff and gaming on smartphones,
I think that's a slower burn than the tail. The tail was describing existing phenomena. The freemium thing is him looking at the way things are going to be in the future.
And his projecting that not only would software be free, for freemiums, but also physical objects. Yeah. And he pointed to things like, you know, people get cars, mm-hmm. you know, for free if you the car was skinned, like, you know.
When you can do that.
And you can, but it's not mainstream.
Well, I mean, I don't want to drive around in a car that has Alpo on the outside. Do you?
No,
I'm willing to pay for a car so that I don't have to do that.
And even if you talk about things like a free phone with your cell phone plan, mm-hmm. I mean, that everything... It's an idea that's easy to understand, but harder to execute in the real world.
The larger, the real world example is what you nailed, the smartphone games with the microtransactions.
Yes, that exactly
is it. A freemium model.
The freemium that by making it free, you get so much more of a bigger audience,
right.
And that you only really care about that small 1%, but because your entire pool is 100,000 times bigger than it otherwise would have been.
Right.
The power of free is very strong in people's minds.
Well, and then the other side of it, another gaming example is like if you look at something like the new PlanetSide game, like that game would never work if only the people who were willing to pay for
exactly.
it were playing.
You're bringing value and you're getting value.
Yeah.
There is an exchange there that works with no money being transacted,
yeah.
which is very cool.
And it is kind of a new idea.
Yeah. And then so the third big idea that he's popularizing is this Maker Revolution.
I don't think I would say his. What he's saying is that the maker culture is the future of new American manufacturing.
Let's explain his argument.
Okay.
And why we may agree and disagree.
Have you read the book, or did you just listen to the book?
I have the podcast, okay. And I'm through part of his book. But the two things I recommend people listen to is the podcast of his talk. It's just an hour and a half long from last week. It's on the site, linked on the site. And also a video of the talk he did at Maker Faire last year. About DIY drones.
That's the one that Wes went to, right?
I don't think any of us went to that one, but that was at Maker Faire, and it's on fora.tv. But it's a talk that he's kind of practiced down. It's a really, really great talk because he talks about growing up in the shadow of his grandfather, who was the inventor of the sprinkler system.
Like the pop-up thing?
The pop-up sprinkler system.
Okay.
And how hanging out, you know, with his grandpa and learning what his grandpa did right and wrong because his grandpa patented his object. He sold the license and didn't manufacture things himself. Had this big idea, but he talks about how he went to visit the factory where these sprinkler systems were being produced,
mm-hmm.
and how his grandpa just didn't get it. Like, and he was almost ashamed of his grandpa at that point because...
You mean like he didn't get the manufacturing process?
The idea had gone beyond him. It's out of his... It no longer belonged to him.
Oh, so he understood how it worked when it was in the backyard, but he didn't understand how the stuff that made it into a thing worked.
And also how it could scale and be refined.
Yeah.
And he was an ideas guy. But he didn't own that system. Like, he didn't take it to market. And he couldn't. And then
is a really hard thing to do.
The whole point of that story is that is very difficult to do.
Yeah. Even if you want to make something dramatically simpler than a lawn sprinkler.
And there's a whole movie.
Yeah.
There's a movie of the guy who tried with the...
Tucker, the man in his dream?
No. It's the windshield wiper
is about. Oh, the one about the auto industry stealing his intermittent windshield wiper. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the inventor of the intermittent windshield wiper...
He killed
tried
himself,
taking,
didn't he?
No, he didn't. Everything worked out at the end.
He had a massive lawsuit. Yeah.
He sued and he made money back. But he went through a huge bout of depression.
Well, you know the Tucker, a man in his dream story, right?
No, what's the Tucker, a man in his dream?
So Tucker, as played by Jeff Bridges, wanted to build a new car company. He's basically the Elon Musk of his day.
Okay.
And this was in the post-World War II boom, I believe. So he launched a new car company. He did it basically Saturn style and sold licenses to dealerships before he had any cars built. And he wanted to build the safest car on the road and all this other stuff. And the big three basically destroyed him.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well,
it was a Disney movie. You should watch it. It's fantastic. Highly recommended. It's kind of a downer, though, I guess. I didn't mean to spoil the movie. Anyway, so his point, Chris Anderson's point, is that the things that we've been seeing coming out of Maker Faire, like the $1,000 underwater ROV drone.
Yeah, so it's more like his experience. And, you know, yes, 3D printing is part of it.
Yeah.
But
it's a component, not the whole thing.
It's a very it's a small component. Desktop manufacturing is still very much in its infancy. And as much as you want to say the 3D printing has had its Maker or Macintosh moment, that analogy is more sensational than the truth.
I think that's true, though, because if you think about the Macintosh as a useful computer,
yes,
I think that it has had its Macintosh moment. I mean,
but at the rate that technology is supposed to grow these days, we're not moving at that pace yet.
Well, the thing
it has not hit the point on the growth curve where Max popularized computers to the point where 3D printers are that popular.
But when Max popularized computers, most of the people that were buying those computers didn't really have a use case for them, and they ended up being machines that played Oregon Trail for their kids.
And it totally talks about that too, how, you know, when computers came out, it, you know, the dad, you know, brought one computer home, shared it with the family, and some people just use it to play games and spur the whole industry of games, and that pushed computers forward also. And then some people use it to learn to program because they were, they had fun with, you know, their basics and stuff like that. And people are doing that with MakerBots as well.
But in a lot of ways, the first kind of real, like, home computer killer app before the internet was Quicken, I think. Because then all of a sudden you had something you used to balance your checkbook, which is something that you hated doing before. It was a custom spreadsheet, basically.
Yes, and it's the reason why Excel is super interesting. It's powerful in ways that our mind can barely comprehend. Just like so many numbers being meshed together and things being projected out.
Right. Three-dimensional spreadsheets, that's the future.
So
right now it's only two dimensions, X and Y. If you bring a Z dimension into that, I can't, it's the future.
Reasons I didn't study finance.
Yeah, fucking. Ugh. Yeah. Finance. Anyway, so I think finance is accepted too.
3D printing, desktop 3D printing, a huge part of it. And there's a great story that he tells about how, and he tells us in the same story in the book, and it's in the Wired article, which is an excerpt, I think, from his book, about trying to get furniture for his kids. Mm-hmm. So his kids have like an allotted 1 hour of game time. Mm-hmm. And I think his kids love The Sims because people, and there's a really powerful reason why people love games like The Sims.
Sims and Minecraft are like the same kind of thing.
Yes, because Minecraft more so, because Minecraft is just like a 3D modeling program.
Well, the thing
in game form.
I think the thing that appeals to the kids that I watch play The Sims, it seems the thing that appeals to them is that they have real total control over that.
And there's creativity. I mean, you're decorating. It's a virtual dollhouse
or an ant colony. Yeah, but a dollhouse in this metaphor.
And you can decorate it, and you can create items, and there's ownership, and the thing you create is going to be unique to you, and it's a very powerful thing. Game designers know this.
Yes.
And his daughter specifically loved The Sims. Loved it more so than their real dollhouse.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure he had a pretty fancy dollhouse.
And I'm sure it was a pretty fancy dollhouse. And so he talked about how he encouraged them to go back to the dollhouse, but they didn't like it because the things they bought from the dollhouse, they just bought them. And there were problems with the dollhouse industry, many problems.
Well, there's probably a bunch of different scales, right?
Exactly. He talked about how, one, there's no standard size. If you buy a bed for your dollhouse, it's going to be two times too big for your dolls or whatever.
Yeah.
And two, it's super expensive.
Because it's a weird niche thing that there's not mass scale.
And three, there's only a few styles. If you want a bed, it's going to be a Victorian era bed, and that's it. You're not going to get your Art Deco, and I mean, it's very rare.
It's not thematically appropriate, is what you're saying. And this is even in the world of the internet, where there should theoretically, according to the tail stuff, be a market for Art Deco dollhouses.
But the thing they're finding now is that those things are then 3D printed also.
Right.
So what he did was that he went on Thingiverse, and he has a 3D printer and a MakerBot, downloaded something from a
Pretty
small things.
Who's a set designer? We printed some of her stuff in the Mystery Object before.
And designed with his daughters and scaled it properly and built a perfect chair.
And then they took it and they printed it and painted it.
And now it doesn't sit in the dollhouse. It sits, it's displayed in the room because it's something that they're very proud of.
Well, and so the interesting thing about, and I've done that before too. Like I've taken the Gear Hearts or the Futurama Brain Slug and painted it and done the whole. And it's really oddly satisfying, even though for all intents and purposes I'm Xeroxing something.
Yeah.
You know, it's the equivalent of a three dimensional Xerox.
Yeah. And it goes back to what Adam was talking about last year, how that you can copy, and you can make something that someone else has already made, but as long as you made it,
it's still yours.
It's still yours, and you have this great connection with it. You don't need to be completely original.
So the other interesting thing that comes out of the 3D printers in this whole idea, and this was from the Wired story, and something we've talked about with Bree years ago, is that when the resource, so if you want to go and make, say, a headphone hook that goes underneath the desks, at that point, it's expensive to do the setup and do the first one. But after you make the first one, the cost goes down each time as you amortize the cost of the setup over the production run of whatever it is you're making, whether it's a headphone hook or that iPhone dock with a big aluminum iPhone dock or whatever. When you're doing something that's on a 3D printer, the time, the resource that you're using is the time that it takes the printer to run. So depending on the complexity, that can be anywhere from, you know, 15 minutes to 2 days for something the size of a replicator, replicator two. And when that becomes the gate, then there's no cost to making it custom, making stuff custom and making unique items each time, mm-hmm. other than the time it takes to change your model or to redesign it and then the time it takes on the printer.
And that's one side of it. And on the other side, with companies like Alibaba and direct access to factories in China,
yeah.
you can mass produce thousands of things at super low cost. You have direct access to mass production.
You don't have to fly to China. If you, right. I mean, you can,
and
people who do.
10 years ago, 15 years ago, you would have to been flown to China.
You have to open a China office, basically.
Right, and you have to take meetings, tour the factories, yeah. get a translator, and it's and do quality control and everything. And now all of that is automated.
Yeah.
And not only is it automated, it's a wizard. It's a form online.
For simple stuff. Even for more complex products.
Things like motors.
Yeah, but like for, I can't remember what I was talking about. I think it was the Oculus, but no, it wasn't Oculus. Something I did a Kickstarter for the other day, they had gone through and they're sharing, it's the LifeX bulbs. It's the smart light bulbs. They were sharing the process and they're sending somebody to China every couple of weeks because it's a complex product. And
that is
sure
a complex, that is a new invention.
Yeah.
But if you need a part that already people, you know, factories know how to
make. If you want to make an injection molded chair, then that's press the button on the website and it's done.
Press
3 days
the button
later.
And someone will walk you through it and the machine will walk you through it. And 2 weeks later, and they accept PayPal.
Yeah.
2 weeks later, you can get a box with 5,000 of those.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
That is the amazing part.
And that's the future we've built. Have we talked about this enough? Should we move on?
Let's move on. But I think the part we disagree with him most on is that the software is still not there. The ease of use. He can tell that wonderful story about his, you know, building furniture with his daughters. But we have MakerBots, and it is not something that someone can just pick up.
Well,
even with the software like Autodesk, 123D.
Yeah.
Like even though you can sculpt stuff, the software is still very, very much in its infancy.
So, like, this is a story I've written and trashed two or three times now because the. Like, as somebody who's been using MakerBots since the beginning of MakerBots, I mean, we bought the very first one, not the very first one off the line, but the very first model that they produced, and we've been through probably 30 or 40 software revisions in the last 2.5 years mm-hmm. with them. And I see where they started, and I know where they are now, and it is dramatically improved software. It's much easier for me to use.
But it's still not at that point.
But, I mean, that's the thing, is when you haven't spent as much time with the 3D printer, and when I'm out and you have to print something, you still, at this point, send the file to me yep. to be sliced
just
and produced.
And the slicing part.
And then you jam it through the printer. And yep. even then,
the printer fails in ways that
It's novel and hard. Yep. Unless you've been using it for a long time, I can look at it and say, oh, yeah, it did this. It made this particular mistake mm-hmm. because the build platform is not perfectly level. But you look at that, and that mistake looks like one of 35 other identical mistakes. And it's really hard to troubleshoot.
If you compare it to a printer. I mean, we are not at a printer where you can do Control-P and print yet.
And just press OK. The thing that I would say is, and I've been telling a lot of friends who have kids this, a $400 3D printer, which you can get now, I want to say the Utilimaker, but I don't think that's it, one of the cupcake variants, is an amazing gift to give like a 12-year-old kid. If that and free software like 123...
The right 12-year-old,
obviously. But that plus 123D design, which is a free piece of software from Autodesk and will produce files that are importable into the slicing programs, is for somebody who has a lot of time, is a real opportunity to learn stuff. In the same way that when my parents got me a computer, it was an opportunity for me to learn something completely new at my own pace when I had free time to do that.
Yeah.
It's more difficult now because I never would be proficient with 3D printers if I had to do it in the time that I had outside of work. But it is improving every day. And the difference in Makerware now, Makerware is the MakerBot custom, their software, their proprietary stuff. The difference between it now and when it launched in September is astounding. In 2 or 3 years, it will be easy enough for normal humans. But
2 to 3 years.
2 to 3 years, yeah. Let's talk about Mobile World Congress a little bit, because that's going on right now. It's not been super interesting this year. It's usually, it's in Barcelona. Is that mm-hmm. right? And it's usually the place that like the main brunt of cell phone reveals happen for the year.
Cell phone announcements before everyone started hosting their own events. And of course, outside of Apple, typically happen at CTIA.
Yeah. Which is,
and Mobile World Congress.
Yeah. CTIA is in March usually, right?
The CTIA has different variants.
There's a business one. There's a consumer one. Yeah. Okay.
Consumer one. Yes. And Mobile World Congress, I don't know how that is timed, because obviously they're beholden to Google's schedule for OS releases.
Android releases.
And then they're also now taking into account Google's own phone releases and also Apple's releases.
Well, I think Mobile World Congress probably says, hey, we're doing this now, and if you want to come, then go nuts.
And also the way they've announced phones is that, you know, they'll announce something, and then in the past, in 2010 and 11, you wouldn't get the phone for another couple months. It'll be a slow rollout internationally.
Yeah.
Because these are international companies.
For example, when the Galaxy S1 was announced, we didn't see the phones for 6 months after MWC in the U.S.
In the U.S. in its various forms.
Okay. So I think the thing that I've been most interested in MWC was a release that came out yesterday and actually is about Liquipel. We saw Liquipel at CES two years ago.
And this year.
And this year again. And it's the nano coating for electronics that makes them essentially waterproof. It's super hydrophobic. The thing that they announced at MWC is that they're going to bring retail locations to coat your devices. Yeah, so right now, instead of shipping... Was this something they announced at CES and I dismissed? Okay. Instead of shipping it off and being 2 weeks without your phone, which nobody's going to do, you take it to the mall, dunk it in the tank, and get it back 45 minutes later or something, and all of a sudden it's super hydrophobic, which is awesome. I think that's really cool.
They need to educate people more about what happens when water does get in contact with it, because you can't charge your phone after a certain period for like 24 hours if your phone is dunked in water.
Why is that? Just because you don't want to short out the contacts on the plug?
Yes. The components are hydrophobic, but electricity will still damage the components.
So it's still not, hey, I can use my phone in the pool.
You cannot plug power into your phone in the pool, but the phone can turn on in the pool.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah.
It's still bananas.
That is still bananas. And then some people...
It's basically a safety net for your phone.
It is only a safety net.
Yeah. So when you went in the ocean and got hit by a rogue wave and your iPhone 4 died...
And they need to price it competitively, because if it's more than $100...
Just get the
warranty.
I really think that this is, I hope that this is one of those things that will end up just being a stock feature on phones in the future. Did you get to handle something that had been liquid-pelled when you were at CES?
Yeah.
So when we saw it the first year, I remember it felt a little bit off.
Did not feel off at all.
Didn't feel different at all this year.
Exactly the same.
That's very exciting.
But those were newly liquid-pelled things. Who knows? And the big thing that we don't know is how liquid-pell works over time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's going to wear down over time. It definitely, like, and just the other nano coatings that we've seen and I've seen tested, like, there's a period of time at which they repel stuff in water, and then that becomes less powerful over time, which isn't unexpected, I guess. What else is happening at CTIA? There's a HP announced their tablet stuff finally. Or their follow up to the webOS tablets, I guess.
They did announce a 7-inch tablet that was just moderately, it was nothing special.
Is it Windows 8 or is it
no, it's
Android?
It's Android.
Okay.
Yeah. It's their first Android tablet. The pricing is good, $170, and it's to compete with Nexus, and I think it has an SD card, micro SD card also. But otherwise, it looks
just generic.
Very generic.
Well, it's interesting because HP has traditionally been one of the best partners, one of Microsoft's best partners, you know, in the post-Dell world.
And they have tons of Windows 8 PCs and convertibles.
But it's not a Windows 8 7-inch tablet.
No.
Yeah. Interesting. Anything of note at all about that? I mean, Meg Whitman came out and said, hey, we've made a mistake neglecting the tablet market a few weeks ago, or last week, I guess, earlier this week.
Yeah. I don't know what HP can do.
Other than make products, and
they did make good products.
Yeah. It's unfortunate because they did touch stuff way earlier than anybody else did on the PC.
Everyone wants HP to get into 3D printing, desktop 3D printing. It just makes sense for that company for with their history and money is in printers. They need to buy a 3D printing company, but the companies that are really pushing for a consumer 3D printing, even more so than MakerBots, is 3D systems.
Yeah, and those are the you talked to, well, Keith, who used to be at MakerBot and now works, you talked to him at CES, right?
Yeah.
The Galaxy Note 8.0, is this an 8.0 8-inch Note?
It is a Galaxy Note that's 8 inches.
Is it still a phone?
I think can Samsung would
phone?
Say, yes, it can be a phone.
Oh, my
Samsung
God.
Would say the Galaxy Note is neither a phone nor a tablet.
So, but
it's Galaxy Note.
Hold on. Do you take calls on it?
Yes, you can take calls on it.
That means
let me confirm this.
This is we better not mess this up. I'm coming around on the Galaxy Note. I'm going to go ahead and say that. I think that I got to use one the other day.
Which one? The two. Yes, and the two.
Like the pressure sensitive stylus makes taking notes on that thing actually possible in a way that it hasn't been on any other tablet.
And
I've
also
ever used.
The screen being that big allows you, regardless of the resolution, allows the OS to show you things like entire calendars. And that's the big thing for me.
So the problem with it is that I would have to get different pants. Like it did not fit in my pants pocket.
No,
at all.
5.5-inch phone tablet will not fit in your pants.
While you're looking at that, let's see. Sony has announced that they're going to support Firefox OS, which is interesting. In addition to with device, they're actually going to release an experimental ROM for the Xperia E, which is one of their existing Android phones. So I'm kind of interested to see how that shakes down. Any luck on your Note 8 hunt?
No, everyone's comparing it to the iPad Mini, which I guess makes sense.
I'm looking up phone. Yeah, it has a car dock. I got that.
Well, there you go.
It says it's a phone.
It's a phone.
It's
That's
a
what
GSM
I
phone.
That's what I thought.
Wi-Fi, GPS, Bluetooth. It's not a GSM device, nor will it work on any... Oh, wait, I'm sorry. I take that back. It is a tablet with no support for GSM voice communication. So it is
so
a
tablet, pure tablet. There it goes.
I can buy.
I'm glad we checked that. 8-inch pure tablet, iPad mini competitor. I mean, the pen is the big thing. And we should talk about the importance of pens or the relevance of pens.
Yeah, did you read the
Penny Arcade?
The Penny Arcade thing?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so Gabe at Penny Arcade, who's the artist,
mm-hmm.
Microsoft sent him a Surface Pro, the x86 Surface.
Yep.
And he used it
to draw
like
comics.
Specifically to do his job.
Yes.
And had a lot of really kind things to say about the touchscreen.
He said that the pressure sensitivity was really good. The only problem he had with it was the size of the screen compared to what he's used to.
And in his context, it was too small.
Too small because
he's used to like a 20 inch tablet.
To a Cintiq, the Wacom. Yeah. Wacom.
Which means that Panasonic 24-inch tablet that you guys saw, did you see it as ES? I can't remember.
Panasonic.
The enormous tablet.
We didn't see the Panasonic.
Okay.
No.
Is much, or maybe it was Lenovo, enormous tablet.
We saw Lenovo had the big 24-inch all-in-one desktop, but that one did not have
that was not
real
a
pen
breakaway
support.
Tablet. Yeah. Panasonic basically had a Windows 8 tablet that was huge for designers. And makes that like it's something we would never test because we don't draw.
Right, we can't. We are incapable of adequately testing it because our doodles are not what artists expect.
Yeah.
When artists are testing tablets, Cintiqs or styluses on tablets, they are using
it's
things
a different
that we can't consider.
Yeah, different set of criteria. But it was an interesting read. It was on Penny Arcade on Monday, I think, so you should go back and find it.
And he, to be clear, he would recommend this. I think price-wise, is much better than paying for a Cintiq, which is not a computer.
A Cintiq is a monitor with a touch surface on it,
right.
Or a stylus surface on it.
And this is a full computer, and you don't need to tether to anything. And this is why Microsoft, I mean, this and Lenovo's, the Lenovo hybrid that's coming out.
Yeah.
Same thing with the pen, good touch pressure sensitive stylus,
uh-huh.
And you can just sit on a couch in front of a fireplace and draw,
or take it with you when you go on vacation,
or draw on
there were a couple of caveats. It doesn't work with Photoshop. The touch stuff doesn't work with Photoshop right now. The drivers aren't there. But if you are an artist and you're into it, it was an interesting take on that product, I thought.
I think this is where Microsoft should have gone.
It's a tiny market.
To build good word of mouth,
It is a,
if there's
a tiny vocal market,
including a stylus.
Yeah, they should have sent it to every webcomic person in the country, is what you're saying.
That's what Samsung did. If you go to CES, for their notes, they hired artists to draw on the note to prove. Yeah. I mean, because if it's good enough for an artist, then guess what? It's going to be good enough for someone taking notes.
Yeah, but that whole system breaks down because the artists are paid spokespeople and, you know.
Well, they don't need to be paid spokespeople.
Well, if they hire them to come and work in the booth, then they need to pay them.
I'm saying that Microsoft should have went out to artists initially.
Seeded the tablets. Yeah.
Lots of tablets.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, if you're using it in a work context, then $1,000 for something that may be a little limited, but gives you the freedom to travel and stuff is not out of the ordinary.
And it's can be your primary PC.
Yeah. Or at least your primary mobile PC. Do we want to talk about the Firefox OS stuff at all? I'm interested to see that. I don't know if there's room for more operating systems. I can't imagine if I were making my $200 or $300 bet on a phone that I would go with the Firefox OS over Android or iOS or even Windows Phone. But anything else from MWC? Like I said, it was a real slow compared to last year when we had a ton of Android announcements and
stuff.
It's
still going on, so.
Yeah, it seems like people are going to do their own events. Samsung's going to have an event for the Galaxy S4 real soon.
March 14th.
So we'll know more about that then.
In New York.
It seems like if it's in New York, that means we'll have probably it's probably time to go with the announcement of availability in the U.S., which is kind of new. I would hope if they're doing it in New York that we're going to see actual phones and they'll be available within a week or two.
I think it was probably see actual phones, but I don't know if they'll have availability. I think everyone expects that this year is the big year of 1080p phones. That's the big change this year.
High density.
The shift to A15 processors and that allowing 1080p phones.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's necessary.
There were rumors last week about Google doing retail stores similar to the Apple Store or the Microsoft stores. Mm-hmm. Andy Rubin, who's in charge of Android, said that is absolutely not true. So,
no Google stores.
Well, or are they just not talking about it yet? You know, we'll see. I don't know what Google would sell in a Google store that they wouldn't be better served by selling on their homepage. I mean, they have the world's biggest, with search results that everyone uses, they have the world's biggest opportunity to sell stuff to you. And if they can't use that, then they're not going to get you.
I think you're selling hardware.
Location. Yeah. There's a benefit.
There's a huge benefit to people being able to use your products and also other Android devices.
Well, and the support. To me, the big benefit of the Apple Store, more so than being able to go in and handle stuff before I buy it, is that you also have tons and tons of locations for hands-on support. So you're not in that, I have to send something that's really crucial to me back for two, and it's gone for 2 weeks problem that you have with mail, support by mail. So, I mean, I could kind of see that. I think they would argue that it's easier just to drop. I mean, because of the way Android devices sync to the cloud, like, they can just cross-ship. If your phone breaks, they can cross-ship you a replacement, and then you set it up, you sync it, and it's back working the same as it was before. Is my hunch. IE10 for Windows 7 is out. You can download that if you care. When was the last time you used IE, Norm?
Windows 8.
When you tested the Lenovo?
Yeah, Windows 8.
Yeah.
And IE10 for Windows 8 has been out for a while.
Since Windows 8 came out.
Some people like it. Has good touch support. And I think the big difference between IE7 or IE10 in Windows 7 and 8 is a flash. And that's, I don't think that's built in anymore in Windows 7. It's still separate.
Yeah, that makes sense. Barnes & Noble, let's talk about this. This is kind of a big story. So a couple things happening for Barnes & Noble. The primary shareholder, the guy who owns most of the shares, wants to buy back and make Barnes & Noble private in a, what I would describe...
Like Dell.
Or Best Buy.
Okay.
But with that, he doesn't want the Nook division. So...
I think Nook without Barnes & Noble, although if Nook split off, it would be, if it was a separate company, it would still be in Barnes & Noble.
I think
there.
So there's two things. There's two ways this could go, right? There's always two ways stuff could go. But Nook without Barnes & Noble is kind of interesting, potentially, because then you're looking at a top class e-reader without an ecosystem attached. So it could be the generic. It could become the generic ebook reader.
Quick way for Nook to die.
I think I don't think that my hunch is that this is not good for Nook all around. I mean, I don't think they haven't been able to compete. They've innovated a couple of times along the way. I mean, just to be clear, the Nook Color was the first 7-inch tablet, and they messed it up in some crucial ways for people who wanted a tablet, not a color ebook reader. But I mean, they were on the bleeding edge of that. The Simple Touch was the first touch-based e-ink reader that was usable. I think it was very quickly eclipsed by the Kindle Touch. But they led that as well, and they did a lot of stuff really well. Tying it to a company whose health was tied to retail stores was probably a mistake. I mean, they should have spun that off as a digital bookstore and a retail location. The thing that the Nook has going for it is it is an Android tablet, and if they opened it up to put the Nook app or the Barnes & Noble app or the Amazon app or the Sony store app or whatever other ebook reader apps you want on there, it could be a legitimate generic non-Amazon e-reader optimized tablet, reading optimized tablet. I don't think that's going to happen. I think it's probably doomed.
I think a lot of people buy Nooks because they're traditional book readers, and they go into a Barnes & Noble and there's a giant Nook kiosk, and that retail space inside of Barnes & Noble specifically is very important.
Why on earth, if you had an ebook reader, would you go to a retail space to buy books?
No.
Is it to get demos?
No, you are a regular book reader and you hear about ebooks, and in that transition period, you go to your Barnes & Noble and then get to buy ebook readers there.
You can get you can buy Kindles at Target and Best Buy now. I mean, when you go to
it's different from the book experience.
I think
environment means a lot for the retail.
I mean, I guess I transitioned to buying books online a long time ago and got tired of paying full retail price for books. Because, you know, if you're buying hardbacks, they're $30 at Barnes & Noble and $19 online. So I don't know. I don't know what the adjustment is for that company. I mean, it makes it hard to recommend Nooks if you're in the what ebook reader. I mean, I haven't recommended a Nook in a long time, but it's less of a less viable option now than it was 6 months ago, because without the ecosystem support, the book is not good. And I wonder what happens to all the people who bought books on that platform if they cease operations.
I think they need to. I mean, Nook Barnes & Noble is in a great position to bundle books and physical books and ebooks in stores.
Well, if they could actually get the publishers to agree.
No, just take a loss on it.
Dude, they don't have money to take a loss. Barnes & Noble is not a healthy company. They're in the Best Buy spiral of doom.
Okay. If they could get that is the biggest challenge,
right?
Getting a publisher to agree. But I think it would be very compelling to go into a Barnes & Noble bookstore,
yeah,
and then all the books with the big red sticker.
Yeah, you swipe your membership loyalty card, and then it just shows up on your Nook when you get home.
Yeah,
agreed. That is the dream of, I mean,
and they're the only ones in that position to do that.
Well, Amazon could, except for the publishers hate Amazon,
and also Amazon doesn't have the retail stores. The big red sticker goes a long way.
Yeah, but. To me, the Amazon, the USP on the Amazon, the unique selling proposition on Amazon is better, because then you go to the store, you go to the website, you order the book. Instead of waiting 2 or 3 days for your book to come, you just download it and start reading on your phone, and then pick up where you left off when you get the book 3 days later, if you're a paper person.
With Barnes & Noble, I think it's exactly the other way around.
I mean, there's two sides.
You get the physical book that you start reading with, because you love touching and flipping through pages, and then you can continue reading in your ebook, in your Nook.
Yeah, I for me, once you switch to the e-reader, it's hard to go back to the 5-pound paper book.
All right.
And I let's see, a couple of other small things. If you are an Amazon, speaking of e-readers, if you're an Amazon Kindle iOS app reader, don't download the latest update because it's broken. Make sure you read the release notes before you update your Kindle app on iOS is the takeaway. It's interesting. There was a conversation last night on Twitter about that, because you can remove your app entirely from the store if there's a bug, but you can't roll back to the previous version. And I don't understand why Apple wouldn't allow that, but I'm sure it has to do with gaming the system or something, bypassing quality control or the approval process. And then the last thing is that Josh Topolsky over at The Verge got an hour with Google Glass last week.
Boy, is he cool.
Now, Norm.
So cool. If Google said to you,
yeah,
hey, we were going to launch this contest for Google Glass, and it's going to be a big, it's our big second big video for the product, which we talked about last week.
For a future of the company product.
Yes, and this is our really big idea. So it's obviously, it's perfect for you. We're going to give you 1 hour and let you talk to some product people, and we're going to let you shoot video and take photos, and it's going to be, exclusive access.
And go on the Today Show and Jimmy Fallon.
Did that happen also? Yeah, going to Today Show with a glass?
I assume with the glass. I didn't watch either of those segments, but I assume that he had the glasses on. Because otherwise, a show and tell without a show is a little bit lame.
Would you buy new clothes and groom yourself in a certain way?
I'd probably make sure I had a haircut if I was going to be on the Today Show. Would you? Are you making a personal attack, or are we talking about content here? Am I going to have to cut this out of the podcast?
That was very precious.
Well, there's a certain style.
The Google Glass is bound to style.
If we're going to critique the article, what I would say is I felt it was a little bit weird to get 3,000 words into an article about spending an hour with Google Glasses without actually reading anything about what it's like to wear the Google Glasses. Like, that is my critique of the article.
Maybe there just wasn't a lot there.
There was a lot of background, and then it was like, oh, you can take pictures and video, and it's just like that video you saw on the internet last week. Also, it comes in colors.
Yeah. The big problem with Google Glass, people have said this online, is that it's you can't ignore it. When people are wearing it, like, the idea that you're walking and you're shooting video, you might not notice it, and it's less glaring to you that you're holding than holding a smartphone up and shooting video, yeah, or holding a camera up and shooting video, because it's just a part of where you're looking. That is great from a user perspective. From everyone else perspective, that is creepy.
Well, there's privacy. I mean, and the privacy concern is obviously
that
huge.
That changes every interaction that you have with someone else.
Well, I mean, and is it a situation where somebody walks up to you, they're wearing the glasses, and you ask them to take the glasses off?
There are going to be a lot of those situations.
I mean, there's etiquette. There's a social contract and etiquette that needs to be developed to deal with this. It's the same thing that happened with the rise of smartphones. You know, in the beginning of cell phones, if I was in the car with someone and I got a call, I wouldn't have answered the call. Might change that. I might do that differently now, but I would reject the call, call that person back later, because clearly the person in sharing meat space with me is more important than the person who's making a phone call. You didn't take your phone out and put it on the table at a restaurant or any of that kind of business. You always were silent. And a lot of that stuff has eroded to the point that now people are so reflexive about checking phones that if you're on the subway platform in a group of strangers and one person pulls out their phone, the other five or six people standing in that general vicinity generally will pull out their phone. Just like pure herd behavior. Try that sometime. If you don't think that's true, give it a try. Stand in a group of people at a bus stop or something, pull out your phone, see what happens. Everybody checks their phone. Because you've given permission to look at your phone in the most tenuous of social contracts. The other thing that's concerning that the what it's like to wear Google Glass video and the Topolsky thing helped assuage my fears was the kind of how in your face the display is. And what he said was that video gave a very good representation of what it's like to actually wear the Google Glass,
which is just a little tiny, very, very tiny strip in the top right hand corner.
Yeah. And that, if that is as unobtrusive as it is, it's much more interesting. Because my fear is if you have an augmented reality display and Google's in control of it, you're going to see nothing. It's a pop-up ad nightmare.
Information.
Yeah. I kind of get the feeling that Google doesn't know. Aside from always ability to take pictures anytime and ability to record video anytime. And
is that the killer app?
And sharing what you're doing right now from a first person perspective with somebody else via Hangout. I kind of feel like they don't really know. Oh, and Nav. Like, I feel like they have four things that they think people are going to use that for. And then beyond that, they have
and
no
three
fucking
of those
clue.
Are the exact same thing.
Well, variations on a theme. If you were doing something super cool and you,
I would take a camera and take a picture of it.
Well, okay, that is one way to approach it.
Can't wait for...
Hey, Norm, I'm getting ready to jump off of this tower. Let me hang out. And then you're waiting on top of the tower for the hangout to start?
Well, it's just like, Flickr is being flooded with mediocre
shit iPhone photos,
phone photos that people are never going to print out. Now they'll be also, you know, populated by first person.
To the bottom. I think, I mean, the thing that's interesting to this, to me, so I was really strongly against FaceTime 3 years ago when FaceTime came out, right? We talked about it at length. I thought it was really dumb.
That's not what your wife said.
What?
Well, that's why you like FaceTime. You talk to your Gina and your family.
So in a post-child world, FaceTime is infinitely more valuable.
You became the app lad.
It is the ability to talk to family members like grandparents and sisters and aunts and uncles and all that across the country, especially since they have the high-resolution cameras that don't suck ass now, is enormous.
And when Will and Gary, or when Gary and Leah got married, we had a friend there FaceTiming.
Oh, really?
Relatives to that wedding.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like taking down barriers to that kind of sharing that is easy for you and I, but is difficult for normal people, is much more powerful than I thought initially.
But Google Glass is for people who aren't normal.
It's
supposed to be for everything that's not mundane.
I mean, smartphones in 2005 were for people who weren't normal, and in 2008 they were. My dad bought an iPhone 3GS.
No, I'm saying the use cases, like the footage that comes out of FaceTime footage is great because it's a one-to-one connection and as mundane, and everyone can relate to it because everyone has things to share and someone who's going to care about it. With Google Glass, when it's the first person's perspective, anyone watching it's going to want to see something cool.
Yeah. Well, but cool can have a lot of different. It's a huge set. What people consider cool, like my dad considers me looking at the baby for 10 minutes super cool right now. You might consider me jumping off of Sutro Tower really cool. Like there's a wide variation in what is cool enough to share depending on what the audience is.
I can see some use cases for Google Glass. I just don't know if that's something. I mean, we don't know. It's the honest truth. We don't know. And we hope that there'll be some really neat emergent things that come out of it.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that'll be cool is we're not going to know until people start building apps. We did learn a couple of things from the Topolsky thing and from other stuff that came out this week. One is that the glasses don't have a cell modem by default. They connect over Wi-Fi direct to the internet, or you can use a Bluetooth connection, or I assume a Wi-Fi hotspot on your phone to share your phone, iPhone or Androids.
iPhone also?
The Verge thing said iPhone.
Wow.
Bluetooth over Bluetooth using 4. The Bluetooth sharing, Bluetooth internet sharing profile. If your phone supports that, it should work.
All right.
I assume. And the rest of it runs on the device. It's not using processing power from your Android, from your phone or something like that, which is good. I don't know. I'm super interested in them. When the time comes, I will shell out $1,500 to give them a try.
Could not want a second gen product more.
Well, clearly, but sometimes you pay to be on the bleeding edge. I think that's it for news, unless you have anything else you want to talk about.
No, that's pretty much it.
They did talk a little bit about integrating them with people who wear glasses, which is my fear because I don't really wear contacts very much anymore. And it seems like there will be options for that. Also, it seems like the actual glass, the electronics and the frame are different. So you can wear different color frames if you want to wear different color frames with your Google Glass. Unless you have anything else, let's play some music and talk about what we've been testing.
All right.
Hey, Norm, can we talk about that thing on the desk in front of you now?
We usually do questions. We haven't done questions in a long time.
We do questions after what we've been testing. It's news and commentary, what we've been testing, and then questions.
Okay.
And then outro and fake outtakes. So the formula is really well established at this point.
All right.
What's that thing in front of you on the desk? Paint a word picture.
I have an iPad, I have an iPhone, and I also have a Canon 6D DSLR camera.
A 6D?
Or 6D?
D.
The 60. Letter D.
Okay.
Six and the letter D.
That's a big ass camera.
It's actually not physically that big. Well, it's the size of a DSLR, but it's a full frame camera with a full frame sensor.
Okay.
I have a Sigma 50mm 1.4 lens on the front of it.
It's a sassy lens.
I've been shooting a lot of pictures with it.
So, I mean, you've just been shooting with it for a couple of days now, I guess, right?
Yes.
Can we talk about, like, maybe rather than talking about, like, what you think about the actual camera, because it's probably a little early for that yet. How did you end up with the 6D instead of one of the smaller sensors or the 5D Mark III?
I do not want to buy a camera with a smaller sensor because I think that if you're going to get a camera that has an APS-C sensor...
Mm-hmm. Which like means, the Sony NEX,
which means you are taking photos serious. Your photos seriously. Yeah. You want good quality photos, more than your smartphone. Many people are perfectly okay with smartphones.
Yeah,
smartphone cameras. I think 8 megapixel, 13 megapixel smartphone
sensor. If the sensor is good and there's a glass,
Totally great for sharing. Great, good enough for all your social networking, and even good enough to print out some of those photos.
Sometimes, yeah.
And that will get better. That is cool. I don't think anyone should buy a point and shoot. The small sensor.
Well, what about like that Sony camera?
That's not. I wouldn't consider that a point and shoot.
Just because of price.
I say point and shoot, I mean a point and shoot size camera with a small sensor and automatic.
Oh, like a lens that pops out. And...
Even not the lens that pops out, but. Okay. But if you were going to get a camera with a bigger sensor, that's either Micro Four Thirds size, 1-inch size, or APS-C, I would say get a compact one.
Something you can put in your jacket pocket.
Something you can put in your jacket pocket or your bag, and don't get a DSLR. Even though you can get, you know, a Rebel, T2i, T3i, T3i, maybe not T4i, for well under $1,000.
With a $600,
$700 with a kit lens. I think that you're going to make more use of a compact camera, whether it's from Samsung, Sony, Panasonic, Olympus.
Yeah. I would never put a Rebel in my bag that I carry every day, but I put the NEX
exactly.
in the bag and don't think about it.
Don't even think about in the bag. You're always going to have it with you. But if you're going then from that camera to a full DSLR body, then I wanted to go full frame.
There's no benefit. Okay, so when you say
full... there's benefit. So some people go from... might have had a Micro Four Thirds camera.
Yeah.
And they wanted to go get DSLR. And they maybe got the 7D, which is a high-end APS-C camera from Canon, and shoots great video. And there are definitely benefits to getting a 7D over as an upgrade from a mirrorless camera. Because then you can use Canon EF lenses and EFS lenses.
Of course, you can do that with an adapter on an APS-C.
You can also do it with an adapter. The video is going to be better. You get more manual controls. I mean, there are definitely benefits.
Okay. Things like remote shooting and stuff like that.
You can get some Wi-Fi attachment stuff. But at that point, the camera is going to be $1,100,
$1,200
for the body. And I would rather pay the extra amount and pay something in the $2,000 range and buy a full-frame camera. And the timing is right because both Canon and Nikon have full-frame cameras that are in the $2,000 price range. They're entry-level ones.
So the benefit of full-frame is that there's no crop-based... So when you
use a 28... The benefit of full-frame is you have a big sensor.
Yeah.
That's the easiest way to say it.
But it also means that, like, if the lens behaves the same way it would... It has a 35-millimeter size sensor, right?
Yes.
And that means that when you use the lens, you don't have to calculate crop and stuff like that.
You don't have to calculate crop. I mean...
So instead of using, like, a 30-millimeter lens as your prime, you use a 50-millimeter lens as your prime, as you would with a normal SLR.
Or 35 instead of a 24.
Okay. Yeah.
But yes, you can... But going full frame also means... And going DSLR means that you are... Then also buying a ton of stuff as well. So,
for example,
when I went to shop for a camera, $2,000 seems like a lot, but it's actually a very small amount compared to what I'm now ready to spend on everything that I would have to spend.
You're gonna buy into the lens ecosystem.
Well, not just lens. You're buying into all the accessories, which now you can actually use.
For example,
so when your investment in your 5N. Was $600, $650.
Yeah.
And you didn't need to buy anything else with it.
I have since bought some lenses, I bought cheap manual lenses.
You have since bought a lens adapter for, not that much.
Yeah.
But you didn't need to buy additional flashes. You didn't buy flashes. You didn't buy, a necessary camera bag for it. It goes in your bag.
You
bought a memory card. But you need to be the super fast memory card.
I splurged and got the iFi because I wanted to.
You don't need to. You could spend $15 on a decent SD card. Your investment is still around that price. And
under a grand for sure.
And under grand for both body and lens.
Yeah. And to be clear, I'm really super happy with that. My pictures look great.
And you should be.
Yeah. I have if I want to print pictures of the kid, then I can. And I can put it in my jacket and take it outside with me.
When you buy a full DSLR, mm-hmm. whether it's something like a high-end APS-C one or a full-frame one, you're basically committing to spending, if you want to make the most out of it, committing to spending 3-4 times as much in next year.
So you're looking at buying another $3,000 worth of glass?
Eventually, yeah.
Okay, so what is your strategy on... bought the 50mm lens as a prime.
So I'll go with the big picture.
Now.
So two things, why I chose the 60 specifically. So within my price range, $2,000 is actually $1,860 still on Amazon right now. And Nikon has its competitor to this, which is the 600, the D600. And the D600... many people say it's better, and mm-hmm. feature-wise, there are many features of the D600 that the 60 doesn't have. Dual SD cards, headphone out, more buttons, all sorts of stuff. But you're really making a decision as to your ecosystem, your lens ecosystem.
Yeah.
Because you choose either your Canon lenses or your Nikon lenses.
Yeah.
There are Sony lenses, there are other Sigma lenses, Zeiss lenses, all that stuff, but you're picking one type of mount.
Right. And I mean, in the old days, Nikon, with the AIS series especially, really did an amazing... I mean, I've done a lot of reading about manual lenses. Amazing manual lenses. It seems like Canon has done better in the automatic...
They're basically the same. Talking to Gordon, they're the equivalent.
Okay.
It's a toss-up. So for me, it's who I have, where I can get lenses from, and because we'll potentially be using this in an environment where there'll be
as a
Canon
production
lenses
environment. Yeah.
Around, whether Adam's shop or here, then it made more sense to get this one.
Yeah.
That is why I got the 60, and I'm not going to go into all the features.
It's not a religious war or anything like that.
No. It's practical. We'll talk about all its features.
Yeah, well, I mean, we'll do a full review at some point, I assume.
But the grand plan is to buy what readers have alerted me is the Holy Trinity of Canon lenses.
Okay.
Which is a, I believe, 16 to 35 millimeter.
Why that instead of the 18 to 55?
There is no 18 to 55.
Yeah, there is. Oh, no, the 18 to 55 is the Nikon, sorry.
Is the Nanny X.
Yeah.
16 to 35, the 24 to 70... So you get that range covered as your mid-range, and then your 70 to 200 as your telephoto.
Okay.
And your 16-35 is your wide. And all of those are 2.8 lenses, f2.8.
Okay.
Super low.
Yeah.
Or super wide. And they're all in the Canon L series, which I think stands for luxury.
Okay.
And those are all ranged between $1,500 and $2,000, each of those.
So, I mean, so why the zooms instead of just buying some fixed lenses in those same ranges?
Oh, no, and then you could buy primes to complement that. So I did start with the prime. Most people, when they buy DSLR Canon, they're recommended to get the Canon 50mm 1.8, mm-hmm. which is affectionately known as the Nifty 50, and that is $110.
Yeah, that's a good deal for a really fast... 50mm lenses, for whatever reason, seem to always be fast. I have a 1.4.
1.4 is fast. 50mm is what people use for portraits mostly.
Yeah.
If you're using that on a full frame, it's perfect for portraits.
Yeah.
You can't get super close. You can't get macro shots, but it's fine. It's what I have now, but I have the more expensive 50mm 1.4 from Sigma.
Yeah. Which you like bokeh.
It's bigger and has more aperture blades. One more aperture blade. But you know, shooting with it, I need to buy a second lens soon.
So gone out and gone on walks? Have you gone on a photo walk yet?
Gone on a walk through the mission, take photos of people and dogs, take photos of bicycles, and it looks good.
How, what's the adjustment from going through the mirrorless? Did you feel like you were ready to go?
The big adjustment is that I can tolerate higher ISOs on this.
Oh, because it's less noisy.
It's because it's such a big sensor.
Yeah.
Higher ISO is less noisy.
So your cutoff before was 400 or 800?
No, my cutoff before was 200.
Oh, really?
And my cutoff now is maybe 320, 400.
Okay.
I mean, obviously, in early shots.
Yeah.
People are perfectly, they say go to 1600, go to town, 3200 even.
Well, you can use a denoiser as well that'll help.
There's some, noise reduction built in, and some you can do in Photoshop. But again, you're buying a body. You're buying lenses, you're buying filters, you're buying flash, you're buying a tripod, potentially. You're buying a camera bag.
Just a monopod, yeah.
Or a monopod. You're buying a camera bag. You're buying software to process raw mm-hmm. images. $70 for...
So you're going to shoot raw now?
Yes.
Okay.
And then you're buying bigger memory cards also and faster memory cards.
One that has both SD and compact flash.
Just one SD.
Just SD. Okay.
Just one SD.
Oh, bummer.
But $1,000 cheaper than the 5D Mark III.
Well, and you can shoot video too.
And you can shoot video. So yeah. We've been doing some video here, and there may be, you know, a video in the future that you can see untested.
Yeah. We're going to experiment with some.
This camera.
Well, while you've been having fun with a high-end camera, I've been testing bottle warmers this week.
What is the latest in bottle warmer technology, Will Smith?
So I'm going to go ahead and tell you, I thought bottle warmers were dumb 2 months ago before there was a child in my house and before we were feeding bottles. We don't feed bottles all the time, so I don't want to hear any political nutballery. I mean, sometimes if you don't want the baby to starve, sometimes you have to give the baby a bottle. We looked at a bunch of different bottle warmers, and there's surprising amount to them. And it turns out it is an incredible time-saving, sanity-saving device because, and this is going to sound real lazy, but filling a bowl of water with hot water and getting the formula to the right temperature in there or the pumped milk, whatever, is surprisingly hard.
You can't sous vide that?
Well, I mean, I could, but I don't have the sous vide bath set up. So, and that seems pretty wasteful. The thing is, you can't get it too hot or else stuff breaks down in the pumped milk, especially. And you don't want to burn the baby, obviously. So you never microwave or anything like that. So like the trick is you don't want to float the bottle either, cause you don't want a bunch of water getting into the bottle if it tips over. So you have to get just enough water in to have a fair amount of mass in there to heat the formula, the milk without flipping the bottle so much that the bottle tilts. It's hard. And since generally you're doing it and you don't know how long it's going to take to nurse and then you feed immediately after that, having the gadget that does just this one thing, it turns out is incredibly useful because you say, okay, it's going to take 90 seconds to heat up. It has a sensor in there so it doesn't let the milk get too hot. And you hit a button and then you just come back 90 seconds later after you've changed the baby or something. You have a perfectly temperatured bottle every time. Tested a couple. I went to Target and bought everything they had and then just took a bunch of stuff back when it sucked. The one that we ended up getting was the Munchkin Precision Digital Bottle Warmer. You tell it how long. The neat thing about it is you can say, okay, it's like a rice cooker. You can say, I want the milk to be ready in 2-3 minutes, or I want it to be ready in 90 seconds, or I think 90 seconds is the fast speed. You hit the button and it heats it up based on the time that you tell you want it to take, and it was like $30. So I like that one a lot. There were some weird reviews about stuff on it. I didn't experience the problems that the online reviewers had. But yeah, you can get it at Target, $30. Munchkin. So if you're going to have to deal with bottles, it's really good.
Is this something that you could theoretically use for anything else?
If you wanted to have something that was body temperature as a beverage, yes.
Blood.
Do you drink a lot of blood?
No, but I'm saying that if you are a writer and you want plot devices for your vampire TV show,
don't encourage that. Don't encourage that behavior. I don't know what else you would use it for. It's a real specific thing. And it's a weird shape too. So it's... Yeah, $30 was the right price. Okay. I probably could have bought the $25 one, but the $30 one gave you the time thing. I've also been testing...
How much in accessories have you spent for the baby?
I'd say, you mean... Yeah, your camera spend is nothing compared to the baby spend. I mean, the...
Because this is my baby.
Yeah.
And I'm only spending maybe planning on spending four times as much as the body.
Yeah, if you're in for less than 10 grand...
Oh, wow.
I mean, we haven't spent that much yet, but like things like the car seat are $150. And then if you want to put a base for the car seat in each car, that's another $80 per car. And then that car seat's only good up to, I think, 35 pounds or something like that. So that means in 6 months, 5 months from now,
and then what happens?
It's another $200 car seat that lasts until they're eight. And so, then after
how much does the car seat, where does that car seat go?
There's no aftermarket on car seats.
Really?
Yeah,
parents because are that distrustful.
It's it has to do well. Okay, there could be aftermarket on car seats. People the car seat manufacturers shockingly encourage you to buy car seats new, because you don't get recall notices and stuff like that if there's a problem with the car seat and you buy it used. Also, you don't have no idea what, you know, when you're talking about something that the car seat, if they drop the car seat, it could change the structural integrity of the base or whatever,
or the baby.
Well, and you don't want to find that out in the car when the thing that snaps the seat into the base breaks because somebody whacked it with a hammer and then the metal got brittle. It's a load of horseshit. Just to be perfectly clear, like the fear of buying used baby stuff is insane because it is incredibly wasteful. Something that the baby will use for 6 months and it'll go in our garage
and
on
yet,
the off
and
chance
yet
that we
you
have
are
another
not
kid.
Bucking that trend.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and suggest and have that conversation. Hey, let's save $40 and buy. People don't even sell used car seats. They're not even on Craigslist. So, wow. I don't know where you would
so
go find
the landfill
them.
So landfill just full of car seats.
I'd say they're probably people's garages. I'd say if you go into most people who have like a 15-year-old kid, there's a car seat in the garage somewhere.
Well, they save it for the second baby.
I mean, that's the you take the gamble that you're going to save it for the second baby. You can tell if you've done your car seat and stroller research, you can tell if a kid is a first baby or a second baby based on the model year of the car seat and
that
the stroller.
That is interesting.
Yeah, I'm going to go and tell you this. So the stroller thing we haven't talked about.
So you
this
walk
yet.
Down the street now and go, "Ooh, that's an expensive one."
Oh,
well, that's
fuck yeah! You
one.
Can immediately tell.
Wow. So do you like think parents get ashamed. The cheap one.
No, because the thing is, sometimes the cheap one is the right one to use. So, like, when you have the baby carrier...
Are you judgmental?
For infants. No, I'm never... I try not to be judgmental. It's bad for you. When you have the baby carrier, like, you use the cheap stroller that goes with that rather than take the baby out of the baby carrier. Like, if we drive to the doctor, we have to park 3 blocks away, you put the baby carrier in the baby carrier stroller rather than take the good stroller out of the back of the car, unstrap the baby, do all that stuff, and then have her pissed off. Because as long as she's in the car seat, she's unconscious. Like, that thing is crack for babies. The big stroller we use for... We'll probably use more as she's older, one. But we use that when we're, like, when we go on a walk around the neighborhood, or if we go someplace, like, if Gina takes her to the mall sometime, if it's cold out, so she can go out and walk around and be human. And you'll take that there rather than the flimsy one. And then those umbrella strollers for older kids that are just, like, slings that have two poles in the teepee thing. Those are like $20, $30. And you use those if you don't know if you're going to need the stroller or not. You know, if you have a kid that can walk some, I would assume you switch to that and because you don't want to carry the 30-pound awesome stroller. I'm increasingly skeptical of the $600 plus stroller market after buying a $500 stroller. It seems fucking crazy. But it's so, you know, running and suspension and you here's something. Think about this. When you're pushing the kid in the stroller through the grocery store, where do you shop? You don't push a cart and the stroller. If the kid's too small to sit up in the mm-hmm. the baby prison in the yep. top of the cart, you usually like I've been shopping when I take the baby to the grocery store into the bottom of the stroller. So there's a bucket under there for stuff.
So you only buy so much.
You buy what fits in there and then carry
the hand,
else.
The one hand thing.
I sometimes will carry like a 12 pack of Cokes in one hand and then steer the baby one handed in the other one.
The basket.
Yeah, but so like the difference between the cheap stroller, the one that comes with the car carrier that you get with the car carrier, the car carrier just snaps into, and the nice stroller is that like the nice stroller folds up a lot smaller. The nice stroller has, instead of foot brakes on each side, that only one side operates one wheel, one side operates the other, it has like this whole like hydraulic thing that you push one foot thing and it just locks the whole both wheels of the stroller. You can lock the front wheels so that they're always pointing forward if you want to not have like the grocery cart effect. It has an adjustable height handle. So Gina's short and she has the handle down low. I can pull it back and have it up the right height for me so it's comfortable.
Wow.
It has a cup holder. Yeah. Yeah.
That's the Homer.
It's it's the stroller stuff is crazy. I also have been testing this new portable podcast mixer. We're upping our podcast game a little bit. And what this guy does is, it's right here. You can see it. It's a Behringer Zenix 1202 FX and a Reeder. And I were talking about portable podcast mixers a few weeks ago, mm-hmm. and he went and did a whole boatload of research. And after talking
portable,
to him,
portable also just means more affordable too, right?
Well, there's a bunch of different stuff that goes on in mixers. Like the one that we use right now, the big Yamaha that I'm using over here, has some like built-in compression and has the ability to do inserts, which let you compress audio down, do not MP3 compression, but like the actual audio compression where you squinch the low and the high. It does that live as you mix rather than in post-production, which I usually do. This one doesn't do this, but it'll fit in a messenger bag, which is key, and has four mic inputs that provide phantom
for
power.
XLR.
Yeah, and then a bunch of others for line level in and stuff like that, and can do line out and headphone monitoring and stuff like that, which is important.
Very cool.
So we'll be using that for the Atom podcast in the future, and it'll be nice because I can actually use the lavs rather than the big mics. So when we travel and go to Comic-Con or CES mm-hmm. or whatever, we don't have to carry the big giant mics with us anymore.
Because it's powered.
Because it actually provides... I don't know what it is, but for whatever reason, you know, using the lavs with that M-Audio mixer was okay. always hard. You have like... The difference between too loud and not loud enough was like a 16th of an inch on the dial. So this gives you a little more control over that stuff and lets you cut out bottoms and stuff like that so you don't hear room noise as much.
All right.
So yeah, that's what I've been testing. Anything else you want to talk about, Norm?
No, it's good. The questions.
Let's do some questions.
Emails?
Well, but we do the other one.
Emails.
Yeah, we don't do emails. We do
emails.
No.
Questions. Boom.
That was a little hot. If you have a question for This Is Only Test, the email address is podcast@tested.com. We answer questions in audio format, so make sure they sound like you aren't recording them from the top of a ladder dangling out over a cliff. Here's our first question.
Hi, Will, Norm, and possibly Gary, your other guest. My name is Casey from Kelowna, British Columbia. Hometown trivia, Kelowna is the only city in Canada with a Carl's Jr., and our airport ranks 12th busiest in Canada by passenger traffic. My question is about tourism in the San Francisco Bay Area. I'll be driving down through Washington and Oregon to San Francisco soon and was wondering what you might recommend as stops either in the Bay Area or along the way down for someone interested in technology and science. Thanks, and always be testing.
That's some really fascinating hometown trivia. 12th most popular airport. And I think they have Hardee's in Canada instead of Carl's Jr.
Yes, that is true. So traveling down the coast, Computer History Museum in San Jose.
The Evergreen Air Aviation on the Oregon coast has the Spruce Goose. And I think they have an SR-71 and a bunch of World War II. Like, it's a really good aviation museum. It's definitely worth it. It's not like the Intrepid or anything like that, but it's a very cool aviation museum. And they have a few tanks outside too. Computer History Museum in Mountain View, you said. There's another computer museum in San Jose that I've never been to before.
Not the Tech Museum.
Is it the Tech Museum?
That's not a very good museum.
Okay, never mind then. The Walt Disney Family Museum is awesome.
Very good. Yep.
In San Francisco. Mm-hmm. There's a Nike missile battery. If you don't know the story of the Nike missiles, they were short-range or mid-range ICBMs, or ballistic missiles, rather, that were stationed on the California coast to protect us in the event of a Soviet naval invasion. And had they been used, they would have basically wiped out any cities on the coast of California. But there's a battery installation down underneath the Golden Gate Bridge in Marin that's open. It's only open a couple of days a week and on weekends. It's a really cool, really cool tour if you're into Cold War stuff at all. The stuff in the Marin Headlands, there's the spotting locations. They're not really museums or tours, but it's like a 15-minute stop. And they have cool... you can see basically the monitoring stations that were used during World War II in the event of a Japanese naval attack. And those are all scattered up and down the coast.
Hmm.
I mean, they're all over. There's one in Marin Headlands. There's one at Fort Funston in San Francisco. And basically what's left of those most places is big, giant concrete bunkers with bolts that stick out of the ground where they had both the spotting stations and the naval batteries. What else did we forget? What are we not thinking about here? There's a ton of... I mean, San Francisco is a fantastic place to just kind of get out and walk around.
Yeah.
I like to tell people to park in, like, Union Square and then walk... from there through Chinatown and North Beach to Fisherman's Wharf and then ride the streetcar or the cable car back over. Yeah. Well, the cable car is even better, but sometimes there's a big long line for that. Yeah. And it's not as much fun as it seems. The cable car museum is pretty good.
I've never been there.
The Charles Schulz Museum is also good. I don't remember where that is.
I want to say North Bay.
I think it's in Santa Rosa.
Yeah.
Or San Rafael. That electronics shop in San Rafael that we went to that time is awesome. Do you remember what that place is called?
It's a small electronic shop.
Yeah, I mean, and then food stuff. There's a thread in the forums where we talk about favorite restaurants and stuff. Yeah, so that stuff's good. When you're in Portland, I'm trying to think if there's anything in Portland I'd recommend. Ground control is awesome if you're driving through there. The food truck scene is super rad. Just go. Yelp isn't super useful for that. There's a, if you Google Portland food truck reviews, there's a, like, there's a couple of dudes that run a site that talk about what their favorite food trucks are.
And have Google Maps.
And have, yeah, Google Map directions for them. I think that's, I mean, Kova Coffee is great if you're into coffee. It's in a bamboo joinery cabinet workshop in the kind of southeast corner.
Holy crap.
And that's where the cone, the Abel cone was started. And they still use them there. Hmm. I'm sure I'm forgetting something. Start a thread in the forums and people and we'll jump in and give recommendations if nothing good pops up. Let's do one more question and then roll on into outtakes.
Hello, Tester. Gustav from Fredensborg, Denmark. A bit of hometown trivia. Fredensborg is Danish for Peace Palace. No hippie stuff, it's just something to do with the 17th century war with the Swedish, as far as I know. And the question is, which convention would you recommend for a convention virgin? I realize it's all a bit subjective, but which ones do you like the most yourself? Thank you, and keep on testing.
I thought he was going to give, like, options.
Yeah, I was expecting a list, but I guess he couldn't keep it in another time.
PAX.
PAX is great. Maker Faire is awesome.
I think PAX and Maker Faire are the most friendly ones.
Like, for normal people. I would not advise going to CES or E3 or, don't go to NAB. The coffee show is fun, but only if you have to be really into coffee, and it's really expensive.
You're going to make the most fun at PAX and Maker Faire.
Yeah, Maker Faire especially. The New York Maker Faire is great if you're coming from Europe. It's not super far. And PAX East is, well, very soon now. But yeah, so I guess that'll do it for us this week. Norman Chan, anything we want to talk about on the site right now? There's a bunch of good stuff. Oh, we posted our first Wirecutter syndicated. We should talk about this because people have been asking.
Okay.
And as you know, we have both people who write for us and for the Wirecutter, and we're friends with Brian, have been for a long time, love what they do. An opportunity arose for us to use some of their content on our site with their permission, and I think that it overlaps really well with the way we feel about testing stuff. I stand by all of their recommendations for things that we haven't been able to test. I think they do a really good job, whether they're doing hands-on reviews or I actually like it much better when they use other people's reviews to kind of narrow down a big list of products that they want to test into a handful of products that they want to evaluate.
So everyone should do it.
But yeah, it's a great site, and we'll be running some of their stuff, I think, on Tuesdays once a week. So yeah, if you have comments about that, leave them in the forums. The first thing we did was $300 headphones. I don't have strong feelings about $300 headphones, but I thought it was an interesting bit. So that's that. What else is going up? We have your review of the Mophie Helium Juice Pack.
Mm-hmm.
Is up today. Yeah.
Bunch of stuff.
Adam Weathering stuff is up today. You should check that out.
We'll check that out. That's the one. We're going to check out one video on site this week. Check that one out.
And then we also talked about shop safety with him on Still Untitled the other day. So that was good.
Please subscribe to YouTube if you're not already.
Yeah.
Give us likes. We like the likes.
Yeah. Facebook. We like Facebook likes and YouTube thumbs ups. And I guess that'll do it for us this week. I don't know that I have anything to talk about in fake outtakes, but maybe we'll give it the old college try.
We had meetings earlier this morning, so things are pushed back today.
Yeah. We're a little
crammed for time.
Today's outro comes from Mr. Cornelia. We'll see you guys next week. Bye.
Hi there, I didn't see you.
Tested.
Oh my god.
Oh my god.
I had to finish.
Tested.
I don't remember where that's from.
Octobercast. That's why you don't remember.
Wow.
Yeah. I think it was like a supercut of all of the
gas
inappropriate sounds we made during Octobercast.
A lot of inappropriate sounds.
See you guys next week.
I'm gone next week, so you should do a Dadcast next week if you can.
Oh, Dadcast.
That's a good idea.
I think we should just do Dadcast standalone.
Well,
I think maybe this is the pilot.
How much? See how much time you have.
We'll see. Okay.
Let's see how much time you have.
See you guys next week.
Bye.